All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, March 18th. We're just finishing up the introductory chapter on nervous system, and that's going to be the last material that's on your next test. So next test, don't forget, is going to include, it's going to include skeletal muscles, introductory chapter on skeletal muscles, and then the big chapter on anatomy of all the human body muscles, and then fundamentals of the nervous system. So that's chapters 10, 11, and 12. All right, so we're going to finish that today, and that means your next test is going to be on March 25th. That's a Wednesday. So when is that? Is that next week?
Yeah.
Oh, holy cow, that's next week. That means I got to make up a test. Ah, okay. I can just take home. Yeah, just make your own test up, probably. All right, so you got to make sure that you ask me some questions if you have some gray areas, since we're talking about the brain. And so let's not forget, what did I say? March 18th, Bio 231, finish up the first chapter on nervous system. And here's the sign-in sheet. Ooh, from last time. Okay, the sign-in sheet from last time. Okay, I forgot to make some marks. I'll do that really quick. All right, so what about an open lab coming up? Does anybody have a practicum still next week?
Yeah,
a couple people. Okay, well, let's have an open lab Friday. And really, it was so crowded? Really? Oh, no. Oh, no, we got to maintain decorum in the lab. Okay. All right, so we'll have it for 3 hours. So late morning to early afternoon. So let's say, you know what? I might have trouble making it in the morning. Okay, so how about, let's do it from noon until 3. Noon till 3. It's at 12:30? Oh, wow. I don't know what to tell you. Yeah, you need both. Okay, well, let's go back to my original plan. How about 11 o'clock until 2? 11 till 2. 11 to 2. I might be late, but I'll try and be there right at 11. All right, so open lab. 11 to 2. Okay? 11 to 2. Is that? Yeah, so, oh, you guys want to know? Yeah, unfortunately, you guys, I'm going to be the one that's going to be there. So come with your questions. But your study guides are ready to go. You should be working on your study guides already for a long time. I'm going to have mine way before then already. So I probably won't have a chance to bring any. All right, so let's get started with today's lecture so that we can press on to the central nervous system. So this is on the test right here. So what do you see? What do you see happening? A flash quiz. All right. So I haven't looked at this in a long time, so I'm going to need some help. All right, so what did that look like? Let's go back and take a look. So what tissue? What tissue? What tissue? Nervous tissue. Okay, and when you see that, maybe how many different kinds of cells make up nervous tissue?
Four.
No? Two. Two kinds. What are the two kinds of nervous tissue? Cells that make up nervous tissue. You got neurons and neuroglia. What do neurons do? Okay, I tell you what, before we continue, I do want to have a discussion with you guys, but it's important that you don't have a discussion amongst yourself so that people that maybe are stuck in the back, they can hear me without losing my voice. Okay, so if you're talking like back there, somebody tap on her shoulder and please ask her to, yeah. So I tell you what, if you guys really need to discuss something, maybe you should just go out in the hallway, okay? Okay, yeah, so, because I don't think my voice is carrying to everybody that wants to hear what I'm saying, all right? So, and then there's another group right up over here, too, so please, just take care. All right, so let's look at this slide. So, nervous tissues made up of how many kinds of cells? Yeah, two, and they're called? Neurons and neuroglia. What are neurons specialized to do? Yeah, carry electrical information. And what are neuroglia supposed to do? Yeah, support the neurons in doing their job. So on the screen, which of those two kinds of cells does it look like? Yeah, it looks like a neuroglia cell. Doesn't really look like a neuron. And in particular, what's the name of that neuroglial cell? That's an oligodendrocyte. Yeah, oligodendrocyte. And what part of the nervous system is that in? The central nervous system, right? So there's a lot of information on that little slide right there. Some other things, too. How is it supporting the neurons? What's it doing to a neuron? It's insulating the neuron. What's the name of the chemical that's insulating that axon? Myelin. And myelin is made because it gets wrapped around the axon and it forms a myelin sheath. Yeah, it forms a myelin sheath. And this is an oligodendrocyte because you can see it wrapping myelin sheaths around numerous axons. So that's a characteristic of a central nervous system myelinating cell. What's the pathology called when these cells start to be destroyed by a person's own immune system? That's multiple sclerosis. Yeah, so each one of these figures has got a really nice long story. But you probably should know the name, where it's located. And, well, you got to know everything we talked about, I guess. That's not too bad. All right. Okay, so this next one right here. What does that look like? That's a neuron. Yeah, that's a neuron. It's not neuroglia. Specialized to carry electrical information. What kind of neuron? It is a multipolar neuron. And where do you find multipolar neurons? So it's a motor neuron or in your central nervous system. Yeah. Yeah, so it can be. What's another name for a motor neuron? Efferent. Yeah, if you want to say efferent, that's proper pronunciation, but if I say it in class with the echo in here, you might confuse it with afferent. Right? So I say efferent and afferent, just to be clear. All right, so that's a multipolar neuron. And what's this guy right here? That's an astrocyte. So is that neuron or neuroglia? Neuroglia. What's the function of an astrocyte? It makes a blood-brain barrier. Look at that barrier around this capillary right here. And it also carries nutrients from a capillary directly to a neuron. All right, so it helps sustain neurons. And astrocytes also tell neurons how to connect up and how to hook up with each other, which is really important process for learning, which is something your brains are doing right now. All those neurons, all those astrocytes are releasing chemicals and your neurons are making new connections as you look at this stuff. Okay, next one. Yeah, that's microglia. What's the function of a microglia? Self-defense, that's right. It's an immunological cell. Where? What part of the nervous system? Central or peripheral? Central nervous system, yeah. And what do we got here? Yeah, you got three oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system. They're making a myelin sheath, so they're insulating these axons. And I'm not sure I told you what the real function of that insulation is. Oh, maybe I did. All right. Yeah, it speeds up the impulse conduction down an axon and makes the axon transmit information a lot faster, like 100 times faster compared to if it was not myelinated, right? So that's really significant. I'd like my salary to go up 100-fold, right? Actually, I'd be happy with 2, okay? But 100 times faster is what? Just incredibly a lot better. What are these little junctions between the myelin sheaths called? Yeah, node of Ranvier. Okay. All right, what's this? Are these neurons? No, these are neuroglia cells. And what kind? Ependymal cells. Where do you find these? Central nervous system. And where in the central nervous system? It lines the cavities inside the brain. Yeah, it lines the cavities inside the brain. Okay? And it also makes and secretes cerebral spinal fluid into those cavities. And those cavities, anybody know what the name of those cavities are? That's for the next chapter. Those are called ventricles. Yeah, they're called ventricles. All right? And here is a neuron. And what kind of neuron is that? That's a unipolar. All right, and what's the function of a unipolar neuron? What's the function of a unipolar? It's a sensory neuron. It's a sensory neuron, so it has a peripheral process. There is one process that's in your periphery. There's another process that goes to your central nervous system, so we call that the central process. And the central process has these little Bouton terminales on it. So these would be dendrites right here. These would be the axon terminals. And what do we call this thing? The cell body. Yeah, don't call it a cyclops. And I was going to say, here it is again. But that's not it again. That is something else. It's somebody new. That's a bipolar. What's the function of a bipolar? Yeah, it's for special senses. And is this neuroglia or neuron? It's a neuron. It's a neuron. It's specialized to transmit electrical information. And what end is this over here? Is this the dendritic end or the axon terminus? Axon terminus, because you can see these little swellings right there. That might be about it. What's the name of the neuron that you see? What's the name of the neuron? Multipolar, right? And what's the function?
Motor,
yeah, efferent. Now, what's the name of the neuroglia cell? That's a Schwann cell, right? So that axon, where's that axon located? Where's it located, PNS or CNS? Yeah, peripheral nervous system, because that's where you find Schwann cells at. If this was central nervous system, what kind of cells would you see there wrapping myelin around an axon? It would be an oligodendrocyte. Oligodendrocyte. Okay. All right, so I don't know. Is that the last? Oh, here we go. Here's another one. And what part of the nervous system do you find these in? Okay. Central or peripheral are your choices. And I say peripheral because it's got Schwann cells. It does not have oligodendrocytes. So this is a unipolar neuron, right? A unipolar neuron. And these are just Schwann cells right here. They're not oligodendrocytes. And this would be the peripheral process. And then over here, that's going to go into the central nervous system. But this all right here is still all in the peripheral nervous system. And we're going to see where groups of these guys hang out. But I see a second type of neuroglia cell on this slide. What's a second kind? These satellite cells. That's right. So they're just supporting the cell body of this unipolar neuron. Okay. All right. So let's go through a little faster. Just tell me the name of this cell. Oligodendrocyte. And the name of this one? Multipolar neuron. Astrocyte, kind of neuroglia. Microglia. Yeah, microglia. Immune cell. Oligodendrocytes. Am I going too fast? Okay, we'll go through it a couple times. Ependymal cells, kind of a neuroglia. Let's go back. It's a unipolar, because it makes that T. And that is the bipolar. What's the name of the neuron? Yeah, that is the class of the neuron. It's a multipolar. What's the neuroglia cell? Schwann cell. Yeah, so where would we find this neuron and those Schwann cells? Peripheral nervous system. What about that one? What was the name of the neuron? That was unipolar. And the name of the neuroglia cells around it? Schwann cells. Oh, wow, so we did it already. Okay, so there's not a whole lot. Okay, so let's do it really fast one more time. Okay, before I can tell you guys are getting bored already. Multipolar. Astrocyte. Microglia. Oligodendrocyte. Ependymal cell. Unipolar neuron. Bipolar neuron. Multipolar neuron. Unipolar neuron. Oligodendrocyte. Okay, so you should be as familiar as that with these pictures for the next test. Okay, plus you should understand what the function is, where you find them, and any interesting things about some chemicals that any of these cells produce. Like, for instance, what might be a chemical that some of these cells produce? Myelin. Myelin, which is the insulation that... What are the two kinds of cells that synthesize myelin? Schwann cell is number one, and oligodendrocyte is number two. Which one is in the central nervous system? Oligodendrocyte, right? So that's the language you guys got to speak for the next test. All right. So let's see where we left off. We're almost done. Talked about the synapse. We talked about action potentials. Okay. What does every cell in your body act like? It acts like a battery. So the inside is negative compared to the outside. And there, what gives your body electrical characteristics? Since every cell in your body acts like a battery, what's something that your body has that makes it very electrical in nature? There's just not anything that we can... Okay, I like it. I think I heard ions and I think I heard electrolytes. What's an ion and what's an electrolyte? Yeah, it's just a molecule, or it could even be an atom, that has a charge on it. And a couple, what were the two most important that we talked about last time? Yeah, sodium and potassium, and both of these have positive charges on them, so they are electrolytes, and they're also ions. Well, all the electrolytes are ions. And when these things move around, they carry electrical charge with them, they carry electricity with them, and they can move across the cell membrane. All right, so I think we talked about an action potential last time. So electrical properties of all cells are developed because of these ions right here. And when a cell is at rest, these ions aren't moving. So if here we have a cell, or even a neuron, let's just say this is a neuron going someplace, okay? You don't find sodium at equal concentration inside compared to outside the cell. There's a difference of concentration of sodium, and there's a difference of concentration of potassium. So what you have to know is, where is sodium at a high concentration? Inside or outside?
Outside.
Okay. High sodium, outside. A little bit of sodium inside, at rest. All right, what about potassium?
High inside.
It goes the other way around. A lot of potassium, you're right, on the inside, just a very little bit on the outside. All right, so that's the other thing that you just kind of have to memorize. Okay. All right, and then an action potential is an electrical signal moving down, okay, this axon right here. What are the two parts of an action potential? Yeah, depolarization and repolarization. So when the cell is at rest, the inside is a negative charge, and on the outside there's a positive charge. So when an action potential starts, the first phase is called depolarization. That charge goes away. How could you get rid of this negative charge right here? By allowing the sodium, which is positive, to go into the cell, neutralizing that negative charge. And the battery disappears. We call that? Yeah, depolarization. Yeah, it's depolarization, right? When sodium goes inside the cell. What's the second phase of an action potential?
Repolarization.
All right, and what ion is moving for repolarization?
Potassium,
and potassium then moves outside the cell. So I know you probably don't have a really good intuitive feel for why that happens. That's just something you just have to memorize. Okay, and when you take a physiology class, that's when you get to really appreciate how all of that works. Yeah.
So when it's at rest,
oh, I can't quite hear you.
So when
it's at rest, you have potassium inside. Yep. So at rest, you have high potassium inside the cell and high sodium outside the cell. Okay. And then things can change when the cell wants to transmit information. And it can transmit information by generating an action potential. Don't forget, two phases of an action potential, depolarization, repolarization. And you should know the movement of those two ions for each of those phases. That's all there's to it, okay? Okay. I think we're around here someplace. Did we talk about a nerve? Yeah, I think we did. Okay, the connective tissue sheets around a nerve. Well, where do you find nerves? I guess that's important. Where do you find nerves? And what the heck is a nerve? What is a nerve? Are there nerve cell bodies in a nerve? No, you know what? A nerve pretty much just has axons, which is a part of a neuron, and axons are going long distances, so a nerve is carrying action potentials long distances in your body, but the cell body is in some other location, like maybe the central nervous system. And, okay, so a nerve is in the peripheral nervous system, and it's just a group of axons that are grouped together going to a particular location in your body. So it's just groups and groups of axons. So, and they're myelinated. So what color is a myelinated axon?
White.
Yeah, it's white. So it's really, a nerve is really just white matter in the peripheral nervous system, a group of axons, all right? But in the central nervous system, what do we call a group of axons that are myelinated going someplace? We don't really want to call that a nerve. We call it a tract, all right? So it's a tract in the central nervous system. So let's take a look at a nerve. Oh, that's the flash quiz. No, we don't want to do the flash quiz. We want to look at, for instance, a nerve. So here is a nerve. Where do you find nerves again? Peripheral nervous system, right? Not in the central nervous system. What's the analogous structure in the central nervous system called compared to a nerve? That's called a tract. Right, so here, can you see all these axons that are all grouped together right here? And so here is one axon that makes up this whole bundle. So here is a complete nerve, and if we make a nice cross-section of a nerve and look inside of it, we can see that there are bundles of axons that are grouped together. What do we call a group of axons, like this group right here? This is called a fascicle. That should remind you of muscles. All right, and what's the building block of a fascicle?
A
neuron, or maybe better to say an axon. Okay, an axon. And here you can see the axon, and then surrounding the axon is myelin. And then surrounding the myelin sheath is another connective tissue sheath that we call the endoneurium. All right, so we put a bunch of these nerve fibers together into a fascicle, and we can see that they're even bundled together with connective tissue. And that connective tissue is called the perineurium. And then if we put a bunch of fascicles together, right, that makes up the nerve, but before we have the nerve, we got to put another connective tissue covering around all of those fascicles, and that's what we call the epineurium. So epi means on top of, and endo means inside of something, right, the deep one. And the middle one is just called the perineurium. That's what's, peri means surrounding a fascicle. All right, and what can you tell me about this nerve right here? Is it a tissue? Or is it an organ? Or is it a cell? Or what is it? Yeah, it's a tissue. Why do you like tissue? Because a tissue has many different kinds of, I'm sorry, no, you said tissue? Tissue. Ah, okay, I want to change your opinion. It's really an organ. Okay, it's an organ because an organ has different kinds of tissues that make it up. So what are the four basic kinds of tissues again? You got epithelium, you got connective tissue, muscle, and nervous tissue. So when you look at the structure right here, is it just all one kind of tissue, or you see different kinds? Yeah, what about blood? What kind of tissue is that? Yeah, it's connective tissue. All right, what about this epineurium right here? That's connective tissue. And what about this axon right here? What kind of tissue is that? That is nervous tissue. So here is a structure that's made up of different kinds of tissue, so it is really an organ. All right, so please be aware of the building blocks that make this nerve up together, and it even includes blood vessels, okay, right here. So that's something that we don't see in tracts in the central nervous system. We don't see arteries and veins coursing along different tracts deep inside the central nervous system. Okay. All right, so I think the next topic that we want to look at is the reflex. All right, so reflex is just a nice basic neuronal organization of the nervous system. It's got some structural components to it, but it allows for your body to protect itself very, very quickly. So it's going to respond to harmful stimulus, and your body's going to protect itself by getting out of the way of that harmful stimulus. All right, so let's look at a reflex arc. These are the parts of a reflex arc. It always starts with a stimulus, and it always ends with a response. So those are the two endpoints for a reflex arc. All right, and in order for you to appreciate a stimulus, guess what you have to have? Okay, so for instance, if unfortunately you were born without eyes or a retina, or something happened to your eyes while you're living, what are you going to be missing for the rest of your life? Yeah, sight. You won't be able to see anything. Right, so in order to appreciate a stimulus, I mean, somebody can shine a light on you, but you just won't ever see it. So in order for you to appreciate a stimulus, you need a receptor for that particular mode of energy or modality of energy. All right, so what are some different kinds of energy? Well, there's light energy. There's a mechanical wave that moves through air that's a sound wave. There's pressure, right? If somebody were to poke you, you'd be able to feel that pressure. That's a mechanical stimulus to some part of your body. If somebody put an ice cube on you, could you feel that? Absolutely. You'd feel pressure, but that's probably not the thing that you would notice. You'd notice what? It was cold. So you have thermoreceptors, you have temperature receptors on your skin, and in order for you to perceive temperature, you got to have those receptors that can then send signals to the brain. All right, so the receptor passes information to sensory neurons. What's another name for a sensory neuron? That would be an afferent neuron that takes signals to the brain into the central nervous system. All right, and then once it's in the central nervous system, there is something that we call an integration center, and that is a neuron all by itself, and that's usually we could talk about the kinds of neurons. I'll show you a picture, and then I'll ask you, okay, a little bit. Integration center is a multipolar neuron that's completely within the central nervous system. And those kinds of neurons sometimes are given two different names. Multipolar neurons that are completely within the central nervous system sometimes are called association neurons, or they're called interneurons because they're connecting different neurons up together. But I think we have a pretty good picture here in just a second. The integration center is a functional center. It's got to make a decision on what to do with that information. Right? So if it's a painful stimulus, then that neuron is going to figure out ways to move your body away from that painful stimulus so that it doesn't cause any more damage to your body. Right? So it's going to send signals to muscle fibers to contract muscles so that you get out of the way of that painful stimulus. And so what kind of nerves are necessary to send signals from the central nervous system out to effectors in your body? For instance, like for skeletal muscles, to get them to contract. Okay. Well, I'm not quite sure I heard. Multipolar neuron is the kind of neuron. But in terms of function, what would we call that multipolar neuron? Okay, is that a sensory neuron or a motor neuron? It's a motor neuron. And what's another name for motor? Efferent. Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Efferent. It's so that leaves the integration center via an efferent neuron. And where's that going to go to? That's going to go to an effector. And that effector is, in this particular case, a skeletal muscle, which is going to move your body out of your way. I mean, out of the way of that painful stimulus. And what do we call that when you're moving your body away from that painful stimulus? That is the, that's the response, right? So that's the end of a reflex. All right, so let's see where we have a nice reflex. Right there. Look at all these nice neurons right there. Okay, so here is a pretty good diagram of a reflex arc. I think we're going to look at some in a little bit more detail. But what does a circular structure here kind of look like? That's the spinal cord. What part of your nervous system is your spinal cord? Central nervous system, right? And then, so out here is your peripheral nervous system. So it's not really drawn to scale because these things would go all the way down, for instance, to the tips of your fingers or something. And how many neurons do you see in this reflex arc right here? Okay, I see a blue one, and I see a, is that a purple one? Okay, and I see a red one. Right, so I see actually three altogether. Right, so this is what makes up the reflex arc. Well, you have receptors which might stimulate this neuron right here, or some neurons can actually act as receptors by themselves. So, for instance, pain and temperature are free nerve endings. If you can think back to the integumentary system, they're just free nerve endings. They don't need a special receptor. So they will send action potentials. When they're stimulated, they'll send action potentials up this peripheral process. What kind of neuron does this look like? It's a, yeah, don't call him Mr. Cyclops. This is what, that's a, yeah, that's a unipolar neuron. What did we say the function of a unipolar neuron was? Was sensory. So here is a nice afferent neuron that is bringing information into the central nervous system, right? So we call this afferent transmission via this nice sensory neuron right here. Yeah. Yeah, because there's one central process that comes down from the cell body, and then it bifurcates into a peripheral process and then a central process. The bipolar wouldn't have that little, like a little stalk coming out of it. It would actually have two long processes coming out of the cell body. Yeah. So, we, you know, before we go, let's do the flash quiz again one more time. And you'll probably pick up on all that kind of good stuff. All right, so this is, we said, a unipolar neuron, and it is sensory. It's bringing action potentials into the central nervous system. And the cell body for this particular neuron is located in this region. So we're going to find thousands of nerve cell bodies because there's going to be thousands of nerves coming into the central nervous system at this level between what? The bodies of the vertebrae. There. What's that hole in the bone that allows these nerves to enter or leave the spinal cord? What's that called? It's the foramen. It's called the intervertebral foramina, right? That go up and down the spinal cord, so that these spinal nerves can enter or leave. And this right here is the posterior part of the spinal cord. This is the anterior part of the spinal cord, so that's kind of handy to see it that way. And this is what we call a root. A root is just a passageway that allows axons to enter the spinal cord. And how many roots do you see on this, on each side of a spinal cord? Do you see two? I see one here, and then I see another one down over here. Okay, yeah, I meant just on one half of the spinal cord. So there's two. There's this one in the back and one in the front. The one in the back is called the dorsal root. The one that's anterior is called the ventral root. We like to change those names around just so you have to stop and think before you say something, right, to make sure you know anterior and posterior. Okay, so this root right here is 100% sensory. There are only unipolar neurons that can enter the central nervous system via the dorsal root right here. And this group of nerve cell bodies is what we call the dorsal root ganglion. Because remember, what is a ganglion? It's a group of nerve cell bodies someplace in the peripheral nervous system. And it's attached to the dorsal root, so that's the dorsal root ganglia. I only see one cell body there, but use your imagination how many really would be in there in your body.
Thousands
of them. So it makes that node, which we call a ganglion.
Question, is there any reason why the cell body is away from the axon?
Yes, there's very good evolutionary sense to that. But it's beyond the scope of this course to tell you exactly why all those are there, okay? Okay. Because it developed over millions and millions of years of evolution. But that's all fascinating stuff. I should teach a comparative anatomy class sometimes, and that would answer your question. How did it get there? All right, so look at this arrow right here. Which way is it pointing? Toward the central nervous system. Does it have two points to it, or just one? Just one. It's a one-way street. All right, so this neuron right here can only be sensory, as opposed to this one coming out of the ventral root. Which way is the arrow pointing? It's pointing out. So this is not a sensory neuron. This is a motor neuron. And when you look at it, can you tell what kind of neuron does this look like? I mean, it's really fancy. It's drawn fancy. Does it... What are your choices? Unipolar, bipolar, multipolar?
It's multipolar.
Yeah, it's kind of chopped off. The dendrites are kind of chopped off. But it's a nice multipolar neuron. And we said one of the functions of a multipolar neuron is what? For?
Motor.
Yeah, for motor. Or what's another name for motor? That is efferent. So efferent signals always leave the ventral root right here. And then here's going to be a synapse. And probably a neuromuscular junction. These boutons right here will release acetylcholine on muscles, causing skeletal muscles to contract, right, to move your body out of the way of that painful stimulus. The last neuron that we haven't talked about is this one right here. And this is what we call an association neuron or an interneuron. And what's the form of this neuron right here? What kind is it? Okay, what are the kinds you got? You got unipolar, bipolar, multipolar. Which kind is this one? This is a multipolar neuron as well, just like this red one right here. Right? Because I only see one axon coming out. Here are the dendrites. So association neurons and interneurons are multipolar, and that's the only kind of neuron that is completely contained within the central nervous system. Notice this unipolar is partly in the peripheral nervous system, partly in the central nervous system. This motor neuron is partly in the central nervous system, partly in the peripheral nervous system. All right, so this slide is also interesting because I could ask you, where do you find the nerve cell bodies of sensory neurons? Where do you find nerve cell bodies of sensory neurons? You would say, the dorsal root ganglion right here. That's where they all are. What about nerve cell bodies for motor neurons? Where do you find them? In the spinal cord. And we're actually going to learn what that part of the spinal cord is in the next chapter in the central nervous system. All right, so this area right here that kind of looks like an H or a butterfly right here, this is darker looking tissue. What were the two kinds of nervous tissue by color? There was, what kind of matter is there? There's gray matter and white matter, right? So gray matter is darker. So what does this look like here? This looks like gray matter. What did we say gray matter was? Groups of dendrites and nerve cell bodies. We don't have any myelinating processes happening in gray matter. And this right here would be the white matter of the central nervous system. What did we say white matter was? Axons that have myelin sheaths. And these axons are either going up to the brain or coming down from the brain to the periphery. So you could think of tracts, that white matter, tracts that are either ascending to the brain or descending to the periphery. And if they're ascending, is that an afferent pathway or an efferent pathway? If it's going to the brain, that is afferent. It's bringing sensory information to the brain for more integration, for more processing. If they're descending tracts, that is an efferent or a motor tract, taking information out to the periphery to get something to happen, to stimulate an effector of some kind. All right, now, how many different kinds of effectors are you aware of? You have effectors that are under your voluntary control. What are those? Those are skeletal muscles. That's the only thing that you can voluntarily control in your body. What are some things that you can't control? Like, for instance, like glands, cardiac muscle, and smooth muscle. These things are not under your voluntary control, but still they are effectors. Okay. So don't forget about this little interneuron right here. Multipolar, and it's completely within the central nervous system. Yeah. You know, all of these do. Okay, so here is a synapse, and this is a chemical synapse. So, for instance, this unipolar neuron has to release neurotransmitter from the axon terminal, so there's got to be mitochondria in there. There's got to be synaptic vesicles with neurotransmitter in there. And that neurotransmitter then stimulates the interneuron to send an electrical signal. All right, so yeah, each one of these should have a little Bouton terminale on there. And then the electrical signal moves over this interneuron, and when it gets to the axon terminus right here, it's got to release neurotransmitter to stimulate the efferent neuron. And so if I was going to draw that picture, or if you were going to draw that picture correctly, you would probably like to draw a little terminal button right there. Right, because it's got to have mitochondria, it's got to have synaptic vesicles that hold neurotransmitter, because that's the only way for signals to go through this circuit right here. So that's such a good question that leads me to ask even some more questions. But if you want a follow-up, that's fine. Just let me say this before you ask me a follow-up question. What's the nature of the signal that's coming along this sensory neuron right here? What's the nature of this signal? It is an electrical signal, and when it gets to the synapse, it can't travel across the synapse as an electrical signal. It gets converted to an a chemical signal, and that chemical signal is a neurotransmitter, and that starts another electrical signal right down this interneuron. When it gets to the end of the interneuron, that signal has to be converted back to another chemical signal, which then starts what on this, on the efferent neuron? That starts another electrical signal that moves down the axon. So what do we got? We got electrical through the synapse, it's chemical, and then we got electrical, and then we got another chemical signal, and then electrical once again. And then once it's down over here, what happens? That's converted to another chemical signal. Yeah. Yeah, so it flips back and forth all the time. Okay, did you have a follow-up question at all? No, that answers your question? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. The dorsal root ganglion right here is just a group of nerve cell bodies for all of these unipolar neurons. Because if something were to happen to, what's in the nerve cell body? What makes up a nerve cell body? You've got organelles in there, like rough endoplasmic reticulum for doing what? Making something, like proteins. What else is in the nerve cell body? You got mitochondria for making ATP. You also have, what is this thing that looks like this little eyeball looking at you? That's the nucleus. And the dark one, the dark center of that is probably the nucleolus. Right, so the cell just can't stay alive without all of those things, especially the nucleus. So that's where the nucleus of this cell is living, and the cell body. All right, it's in the dorsal root ganglia right here. So if something were to happen to this cell body right here, guess what would happen to this peripheral process? Yeah, it would just degenerate. It would just die. Right, so that's what's necessary about the cell body. Yeah. Yeah.
The muscle or gland cell that responds to the efferent impulse by contraction or secreting. So the muscle, be it skeletal or smooth, and then
or even cardiac.
Yeah. So
Any of those. Plus glands, like you said, plus glands. Yeah. Those are what we call effectors. Yeah. And then in two more chapters, we're going to break those effectors down into even some subgroups.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a ganglion in general is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system. And right here, it still hasn't really entered the central nervous system yet, so we call that a ganglion. Okay. So there are some other examples of ganglions that we're going to see, which is going to be a group of nerve cell bodies, some other location that's in your periphery, not in your brain and not in your spinal cord.
Okay, so the dorsal root one,
that's specific to the dorsal root. And if we had, in this root right here, a ganglion, then we would call that the ventral root ganglion, but there is no such thing. Okay, but we're going to find ganglia in different parts of our body. And what they're just hubs of these groups of nerve cell bodies, of certain kinds of dendrites, and of certain kinds of neurons. All right, so this is a nice, we call this a reflex arc, but we don't see the stimulus right here. And we don't see the effector. I think we do have some pictures in your book later on that show that. So what would be a good stimulus? What would be a kind of stimulus? Pain, temperature, light, right? Vibration maybe on the surface of your skin. Okay. How about taste? That's a sensation. Hearing is a sensation. Smell is a sensation. So you need different receptors for all those different modalities. Okay. All right, so somebody was asking me about how is that information processed? Well, in that reflex arc, we saw that it was very simple processing. So if there was a painful stimulus, it would stimulate muscles to contract to move your body immediately away from that stimulus. And since it's controlled within the spinal cord, here's something else that's interesting to mention. Since the reflex arc is in the spinal cord, do you have any conscious perception of what's happening? Like if someone were to poke you in the back with a pin, guess what would happen to you? You would start moving before you even had any awareness that somebody poked you in the back with a pin, because you don't have consciousness provided to you by anything that's happening in the spinal cord. It just automatically makes things happen in your body. So that means what? It happens very rapidly, so that limits the amount of tissue damage that takes place, right? But if that stimulus had to go all the way to your brain, that would take some time. And then if you had to think about, oh, what was that? Was that a tickle, or was that something really bad, something damaging? What would happen? Well, there'd be more damage already. So reflexes happen like that, even without your conscious appreciation. But that signal, once it gets into this interneuron right here, it shares the information with other neurons that go where? Up to the brain. Right, other sensory neurons, so that you do become aware of it just at a later time. Yeah. Is there such a thing as, oh, and a synapse, for instance? Yeah, there is. And it's relatively rare in the nervous system. And skeletal muscles don't have any electrical synapses at all. But there is one kind of muscle that has electrical synapses, and that's your heart. And when we get to the cardiac chapter, I'll mention electrical synapses. And so with an electrical synapse, stimulation can move directly from one cell into the next cell within your heart. And that's really important for the following reason. So here, let's just say we have a bunch of heart cells. All right, and so what did we say caused the stimulus of a neuron? A stimulus was what? Depolarization due to sodium? Well, in cells that have electrical synapses, sodium can actually move from one cell into another cell, okay, and into another one, causing just this wave of stimulation, causing cardiac muscle cells to contract as a unit. So the heart, when it gets stimulated, it should contract as a unit so that it can pump blood, right? If one part of the heart contracted and then another part, What would it do? It would just kind of squish blood around inside the heart, but not pump it out. The whole heart has to contract in a coordinated way together to pump blood out. So the heart has these electrical synapses in it, but skeletal muscle doesn't have electrical synapses. And can you imagine why that's a really good idea? That all the muscles that make up skeletal muscles have chemical synapses, because if it had electrical synapses, what would happen if all of a sudden, if you just twitched your little finger right here, if all the muscle cells had electrical synapses, what would happen? Yeah, you'd go like that and your whole body would contract. Okay, not very useful. So different synapses are used for different purposes, and these electrical synapses are rare in the body. So somebody, that was a good question. Who asked that question? Oh, very good. Okay. All right, so information processing. There are different pathways. Sometimes when nerves bifurcate and send information to different places, we call that a divergent pathway. That's really important for sensory, sharing sensory information. So for instance, I mentioned that this interneuron right here, this is a nice simplified illustration. The interneuron is going to stimulate a motor neuron, but what else is this interneuron going to do? It's going to share information with other neurons in your brain. So it's got to split up, right, and share information. That's a divergent pathway. Okay. Other kinds of pathways?
Question.
Yeah. It can happen in the peripheral nervous system too. I'll show you some examples when we get to this, the autonomic nervous system. Okay, it's just a way of sharing information in your body. Okay, when neurons break into a number of axons, for instance, a divergent pathway. Convergent would be the other way around, and that would be for integrating information. So, for instance, Let's look back at this figure right here. So here we have a motor neuron going to a muscle someplace, all right, and we see that it's only, in this diagram, it's only connected to one interneuron, but there actually might be thousands of interneurons bringing information from all different parts of your body that might stimulate this motor nerve fiber right here. So that would be a convergence of signals. Right, so maybe in this particular case, you feel a painful stimulus from this neuron right here, but you might experience pain from what? Multiple locations in your body, which might stimulate this one motor fiber here to send an action potential. So that's an important way of processing information. Okay, let's see. Reverberating circuits are very interesting. Let's see if I can, let me find the slide that shows these things. Okay. So here would be a diverging circuit where you have one action potential gets split into various components, all right, which then share that information with many kinds of effector organs. Yeah?
When that happens, they have this
signal. Okay, yeah, think about that question a little bit more. Convergent circuit is, for instance, maybe this would be a motor neuron right here, and it's going to receive information from many thousands of neurons that might, this neuron then might decide to send a signal to a muscle to contract, get out of some kind of painful stimulus. And a reverberating circuit, how many neurons do we see in this circuit right here? Okay, I see three. One, two, three. All right, and so once we stimulate neuron number one, right, it's going to go as an electrical signal down the axon, convert it to a chemical signal, it's going to stimulate this interneuron right here, and the interneuron, we see that it is a diverging circuit. So it bifurcates, it's going to stimulate the third neuron right here, but where else does that axon go? It goes back all the way to the first neuron and re-stimulates that first neuron. All right, so once this first neuron is stimulated, what can you tell me about this loop? It has a tendency to self-stimulate itself over and over and over and over again. And that's a real important kind of circuit, because that describes how when you wake up in the morning, you can stay awake for 12 hours. Once you stimulate certain reverberating circuits in your brain, they stay active for a long period of time, and it maintains a wakeful state or consciousness. And we're going to see what part of the brain is responsible for that. All right, so that maintains a wakeful state. And when this reverberating circuit fatigues, right, because it runs low on ATP or builds up other kinds of metabolites, because it's been self-stimulating for 12 hours, then this reverberating circuit no longer functions, and what happens? Yeah, it stops, and then you fall asleep. Okay, so that's a part of the brain that maintains consciousness or a wakeful state. Okay. Alright, so other different kinds of ways of processing, we call this serial processing, where one neuron might stimulate a middle neuron and then a distal neuron. Another way is using a divergent circuit. We call this parallel processing. And this is really the way the brain really likes to work, in parallel processing. And actually, this is really interesting because this is kind of how the internet is set up, with a bunch of parallel processing features to it. Because have you ever been surfing on the web and you start with like one kind of information, right? And you get to a page and what do you see? A whole bunch of other kinds of information, all right? Well, it's related to topic number one and topic number two and topic number three. And then you got to decide, well, what am I most interested in? Oh, I might be interested in topic number two. And then you learn a little bit about topic number two, but you go, oh, but that's related to topic number one. I got to go back and figure out something about topic number one. And maybe you proceed through a couple steps and you go, oh, but this topic number three was important because it related all together, and then you have to go back. And so the internet is set up pretty nicely because that's how our brain likes to function, okay? By thinking about many things at the same time and understanding relationships about information. All right, so it's too bad I can't give like three or four lectures at one time, because that's how you would learn the most, but can't do that. Okay, so I think that's it for this chapter, and we talked about multiple sclerosis, for instance. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much it for this chapter. All right, the next chapter is central nervous system. It's not on your next test, but it's a very important chapter. So this was, what, 12? So we're probably going to 13. Chapter 13. Now, did I pass around the sign-in sheet? I think so. Yeah, where's the sign-in sheet at? Somebody got the sign-in sheet? And if you haven't signed the sign-in sheet yet, make sure you do before you leave. It's probably toward the back of the room someplace. Okay, so lucky 13. All right, what does that look like there? Yeah, that looks like a brain, all right. All right, let's get the word slides for 13. Oh, wait. Wait a second. Is it central nervous system? You know what? There's something wrong with the syllabus. We got to do number 12, chapter 12. Okay, so we're going to do 12 first. We just did 12? No, I think that was 13. Peripheral nervous system. What happened? So 12 is nervous system, 13. Okay, here we go. Module 12, chapter 13. Central nervous system. All right, so first we're just going to understand some anatomy and then layer in some functional information. Now, you probably don't want to leave when we talk about this chapter, because I would say there are probably a lot of difficult chapters in the textbook, but this is the one that's most difficult for students to pick up on by themselves. So for sure I wouldn't leave during the central nervous system lecture. Okay. All right, so central nervous system. What are the two main areas that make up the central nervous system? You got brain and spinal cord. And what's that line of distinction or line of demarcation that distinguishes the brain from the spinal cord? It's something back over here. But there's a line you could draw right between. And above that is going to be the brain, and below that is going to be the spinal cord. So where's that line at? It's in the occipital bone. What's in the occipital bone? Yeah, the foramen magnum, right? So right at the foramen magnum, that's the line of demarcation between the brain and spinal cord. All right, so what I'm going to talk about first right here is the brain. So that's what? Everything above the foramen magnum. And there are five general areas. Yes?
Wait, you say that about it's the one that is making the boundary, but what about in the spinal cord and the brain itself?
The brain and spinal cord are two different things.
No, I know, but is there any physical way without using the foramen magnum?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of interesting things. There are different nuclei, there's different tracts, okay? There are different nerves that leave. For instance, there are nerves that leave the brain that go to your face. We call those cranial nerves. And then once you get out of the brain down into the spinal cord, there are nerves that leave to go to other places in your body, like maybe to your heart or to your arms. Those aren't cranial nerves. Those are spinal nerves. So yeah, these are all good questions, and I'm going to answer them this week and next week. All right, so the five general areas that make up the central nervous system. All right, we got brainstem, number one. I'm going to go through this pretty quick, and then I'll talk about it. The diencephalon is number two. You have no idea what that is or where that is yet. That's okay. The cerebrum. You sort of know where that is. That's the largest part of the brain that makes up the cerebral hemispheres. Right? That's the most superior part of the brain. The fourth part is the cerebellum. Okay, the cerebellum is associated with the occipital lobe. Oh, so there's four areas. This fifth area right here is not part of the brain, but that's spinal cord. So I guess that said, what, five areas that make up the central nervous system. Yeah, five general areas that make up the central nervous system. Okay. The medulla. Brainstem, and the medulla is part of the brainstem. This connects the spinal cord to the brain. So the brainstem is what? Is it superior or is it the inferior part of your brain? Because it's going to be connecting to your spinal cord, right? It's the most inferior part of your brain. And the rest of the brain is evolved from the brainstem. So that's another reason why we kind of call it the stem, right? Not only is it the base of the brain, but the rest of the brain has evolved from the brainstem. And the lowest part is called the medulla oblongata. So let's see if I can find some pictures of these things. All right, so here is a picture of the brain. I can see some blood vessels on the surface. And when you look at this thing, what strikes you as being sort of interesting? Do you see any structure to the brain right here? Okay, look, it has all of these like wormy things in it. All right, it has, and those folds are what we call convolutions. So on the surface of the brain, you see it has all these folds which are called convolutions. So a deep part, right, so, or the valley right here, that's what we call a sulcus, and the ridge is what we call a gyrus, right? And it makes up a convolution, is those two components to it. All right, so this area right here is the cerebrum, and here's a lobe, so right now you could probably tell me what lobe of the brain this is. What lobe is this? The frontal lobe, because it's right underneath the frontal bone. And what lobe of the cerebrum is this right here? That's the? Okay, that's the parietal, because the parietal bone is right there. And then what lobe is way back over here? That's occipital, because that's where the occipital bone is. And then right here is the temporal lobe, right? So even without studying anything about this chapter, you already know a lot of neuroanatomy. All right, so that's the cerebrum. Right below the cerebrum is the cerebellum. We're going to look at that. That's one of the last things we're going to look at. And then tucked underneath and in front of the cerebellum and underneath the cerebrum right here is the brain stem. And that's where we're going to start looking at right now. All right, that's the brain stem. And the lowest part is what? The medulla, medulla oblongata. All right, so that gives you a little overview of the brain. Okay, so right about here would be the foramen magnum. Below that is spinal cord. So here is the medulla oblongata. And you can see it moving up into the brain. All right, so this area right here, let's talk about what some of the functions of the medulla is. Oh, I lost what, which one are we on? Okay, so let's close this one so I'm not too confused. Ah, here we go. I'm going to close this one. Okay, so there are various nuclei that regulate different reflexes that are located in the medulla. So what the heck is a nucleus again? What's the counterpart of a nucleus in the peripheral nervous system called? It's called a, in the peripheral nervous system, it's called a ganglion. And remember what that ganglion looked like on the dorsal root? It's just a group of nerve cell bodies. Well, in the central nervous system, we can't call it a ganglion, we call it a nucleus, right? It's a nucleus. And these nuclei have different functions depending on exactly where they are in the medulla oblongata. There's one nucleus called the cardioregulatory center, and it's responsible for regulating your heart, namely your heart rate. Okay?
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
So what is the center in the medulla oblongata?
Well, there are tracts in the medulla, and there are also nerve cell bodies. Right? If they're tracts, then it's myelinated axons. If there's a group of nerve cell bodies, we call that a nucleus. So there are nuclei inside the medulla. Not, it's not the nucleus of a cell, it's a group of cell bodies that are performing a certain kind of function, like regulating your heart rate. So there is a nucleus. What color is a nucleus? Is it white matter or gray matter? It's gray matter because it's dendrites and cell bodies. All right, so you're going to find like a gray spot inside the medulla. And we found that one of these gray spots regulate your heart rate. So guess what we call it? That's the cardioregulatory center. And if there's a lesion in that nucleus, in that part of the medulla, what has the person lost the ability to do? Regulate their heart rate. Right, if they get a stroke in that area, or if they get a tumor in that area, or if something happens, blood supply is cut off to that area, then they have trouble regulating their heart rate. All right, if that nucleus dies, then the cardioregulatory center is gone. There is a vasomotor center. So when we say motor, what does motor mean? Movement, right? And vaso means blood vessel. So there are muscles around blood vessels that can constrict the blood vessel and reduce blood flow to it, or it can, those muscles could be inhibited and the blood vessel dilates and a lot of blood will flow through that blood vessel. That's what we call the vasomotor center. That helps regulate blood pressure. So, and blood pressure is kind of related to the heart, so it makes sense that the cardioregulatory center and vasomotor center are in the medulla because they work together. The respiratory center is also in the medulla. And do you always have to think about breathing?
No.
The diaphragm is skeletal muscle. You can consciously control your diaphragm when it contracts and when it relaxes, but most times you don't, unless you're playing a wind instrument or singing or something, or if you're a little kid and you want to scare the heck out of your mom, what can you do? You can hold your breath. Oh, you did that when you were little? You can hold your breath until you pass out, right? So that's voluntary control, but because of the respiratory center, I'm just kidding, just because of the respiratory center in your medulla, when you pass out, guess what happens? the medulla takes over and you start breathing again like normal to make up for all the loss of oxygen that you didn't have. All right, so the medulla will take over. Also, swallowing reflexes. The last part of swallowing is involuntary. You can't control it. The first part of swallowing is under your control. But once food starts to go down, what's the name of that tube between your mouth and your stomach called? That's the esophagus. Once food gets into the esophagus, you can't really cause it to come back up. It's under automatic control, and that control then is by the medulla. I've only known one person that had trouble swallowing. It was a friend of mine. He'd swallow something, it would get almost to his stomach, and something weird would happen, and then it would start pushing food back up into his mouth. And it would get almost into his mouth, and then the esophagus would push it back down to his stomach. But it wouldn't get into the stomach because it started pushing it back up again. Does that sound really weird? So it would just kind of vibrate back up and forth, and finally it would go down. But he really would make some really awful sounds while the food was moving up and down in his esophagus. Probably way too much caffeine and way too much nicotine. It was a double-handed consumer. Cigarette in one hand, coffee in the other. Okay. Vomiting. You can't stop vomiting once it starts, right? That's an automatic function that happens. That's controlled where? In the medulla. Nuclei in the medulla. Same thing for coughing and sneezing. And these things you can maybe try to override a sneeze. Have you ever tried to stop a sneeze in the middle of a sneeze? What happens? Well, your eyeballs pop out, right? It's really probably a dangerous thing to try to do even. Okay. All right, so all of these functions pertain to the medulla. And let me see. So here is the medulla right here. Almost looks like spinal cord, but it's a little bit thicker. When you guys start to do some dissections in lab, probably this week, maybe next week, you'll maybe do some brain dissections, maybe an eyeball dissection. You'll see that the medulla is just a little bit thicker. All right, the next part of the brain stem is this one right here. This is what we call the pons. And the pons kind of wraps around this posterior part of the brain stem. See, it's kind of wrapping around like this. Kind of think of it as like my hand, just kind of covering the anterior part of the medulla that's right above the medulla. And the pons has connections that are cut right here. The connections go into the cerebellum. But we've cut that away just so that we can see the pons by itself. So the pons is important because it shares information with the cerebellum, and you got to come back next week because I can't tell you right now what the cerebellum is useful for. But the pons acts as a relay station for information entering and leaving the cerebellum. All right, so next week I'll tell you something about the cerebellum. And the pons has some other functions associated with it as well. All right, so here is the relay between the cerebrum and the cerebellum. It acts like a bridge into the cerebellum. But also in the pons, there are nuclei that participate with the respiratory center. And also, remember that reverberating circuit that we talked about? What was the function of that reverberating circuit? Yeah, maintains a wakeful state. That's called the reticular activating system, or RAS. And the reticular activating system is partly in the medulla and partly in the pons. So there are nuclei associated with that reverberating circuit that keep you awake. And guess what happens if there's damage to that reverberation circuit? Okay? You can't. The reticular activating system, if it becomes damaged, if you have a stroke or a blood clot in that part of the pons or medulla, you can't stay awake. What do we call that condition? That's called, yeah, coma, but that's like a totally unconscious state. You don't even dream or anything when you're in a coma. Okay? It's called, yeah, when you fall, like right now, if you were just to fall asleep, you'd hit your head on the table. We call that narcolepsy, when people fall asleep during the day. And of course, that's very dangerous because you could be driving on the 405, right, and all of a sudden you fall asleep. Or you could be giving a lecture and you fall asleep. And sometimes it can be treated, sometimes we can't treat it because of damage to what part of the brain is too great? The brain stem. The brain stem. Okay. All right, so let's see if I have some other pictures. Okay, so here we have spinal cord, and then here is the medulla. This makes up the brainstem, and right above the medulla, this is the pons, and then the pons also shares information with the cerebellum right there. Okay. All right. Okay, I'm going to stay on this slide right here. Okay. The next part of the brain, midbrain, it's still part of the brainstem. There's something called the corpora quadrigemina. All right, and what does corpora mean? Corpora just means, I don't know if anybody would know that, just means body. Okay, and quadrigemina, that's probably, you should be able to take a guess on that one. What's four something. Yeah, four little bodies. Okay, there's four little bodies that are in the midbrain, and there are nuclei, so there are groups of nerve cell bodies and dendrites doing something in the corpora quadrigemina. So let's see if I can find where the corpora... Ah, look at what I see right here. Kind of looks like the bottom of an egg crate in this illustration. It won't quite look like that in a real brain when you guys look at it, but here are the four bodies. These are called what? The corpora quadrigemina. And you can see that there are two on the top and two on the bottom. So these are the superior colliculi. A colliculus is just one of those little bumps. And then here, down here, are the two inferior colliculi. So one of them is a colliculus. Here's an inferior colliculus, and here's the one on the other side. And then here are the two superior. These are important because, again, they control things that happen pretty much automatically in us. The inferior colliculus is important for localizing sound. All right, so we're talking about the sense of hearing. And when I say localizing, that just means that you're able to tell where the sound is coming from. So if we were to close all the doors so it was quiet in here and then had somebody open up a door without you looking with your eyes closed, you could tell if it was that door that was opening, or that door over there, or that door there, or this one here, even without looking, because the inferior colliculus is helping figure that out for you. Because sound reaches the ear, all right, your two ears at different times. So if this door were to open up, my right ear would hear it first, and then my left ear would hear it. And the corpora quadrigemina would know right away which door it was. So we call that localization of sound. All right, the superior colliculus is not for hearing, but it's for the sense of vision, for seeing things. And this is important for tracking something as it's moving through the air. So if I were to take a ball and throw it, you would know pretty much where the ball was going before you actually observed it. All right, so baseball players have very advanced superior colliculi because they can see a baseball moving for a very short period of time, and they're going to know exactly when that baseball is going to hit the ground and where it's going to hit the ground, if it's curving or going straight or if it's going up or down. And that's really important because what if you're a pitcher and somebody hit a baseball and it was coming straight at you? What would you like to do? Yeah, catch it or get out of the way really fast, right? So the superior colliculus is real important. It helps protect your body from what? Impacts, right? But it also helps you track visual information, so you know something about your environment. So this right here is the corpora quadrigemina, the inferior colliculi, and the superior colliculi. All right, so that's part of the midbrain. The other part of the midbrain, you see these stripes right here? Okay, so these are tracts. So these aren't nuclei. What is a tract again? It's myelinated axons going someplace. So these are tracts that are either ascending or descending, taking information from the spinal cord up to the cerebrum or bringing information down. So it's like a bridge between the higher centers of the brain and the medulla right here. And that's what we call a peduncle. A peduncle is a bridge that's carrying tracts that are going places. All right, so this is the cerebral peduncle because it's taking information to the cerebrum right here. The other peduncle that I see, and then I'll stop after I tell you this, these are what we call the cerebellar peduncles. You see these stripes? These stripes are carrying information into the cerebellum. So this is, these are what we call the cerebellar peduncles right here. It's carrying information to the cerebellum. So if you're going to think of a everyday word to describe a peduncle, it's a, think of it as a bridge going from two major parts of the brain. Okay, that's a peduncle. Okay, so that's it for today. And we're almost on schedule. We're a little bit late because I was talking too much today.